Today in Studio 360, a famous man with a price on his head goes into hiding under an assumed name.
He thought of writers he loved and tried combinations of their names. Vladimir Joyce, Marcel Beckett, Franz Stern. He made lists of such combinations and all of them sounded ridiculous. Then he found one that did not. He wrote down side by side the first names of Conrad and Chekhov. And there it was, his name for the next 11 years.
Joseph Anton, also known as Salman Rushdie. His new memoir tells us what it was like to spend almost a decade hiding from the fanatics who wanted to kill him because of a novel he wrote.
I felt almost like somebody from the NRA saying, books don't kill people, people kill people.
And we look at Andy Warhol's 32 Campbell soup cans, the work that made him famous exactly 50 years ago. That's all ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The novelist Salman Rushdie has always dreamed large, to even be, pardon the expression, hell-bent. He's written stories about how nations come into being, how new ideas come into the world, how the modern world connects to the ancient. But not many Americans had probably heard of Salman Rushdie until he became a big story on Valentine's Day, 1989. That's when Iran's dying leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa, a death sentence, against Rushdie for supposedly blaspheming Islam's prophet in his novel, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie went into hiding for most of the next decade, always accompanied by British government men with guns. He has now published his fascinating account of that stranger-than-fiction time. It's called Joseph Anton. Salman Rushdie, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hi, nice to be here again.
Since most people listening, like all the people who think you're a terrible blasphemer, haven't read the Satanic Verses, I think it's important to remind them in this week of all weeks probably that it is in no way an anti-Islamic satire or polemic or screed, right?
Right. I mean, it's not even mostly about Islam. I mean, it's mostly about people migrating from the Indian subcontinent to London and the consequences of those migrations. And one of them is that one of the characters has lost his religious faith and is therefore persecuted by dreams about the creation of that, something like that faith. And in those dreams was the material which all the trouble was about.
Right. And it's dreams. It's not literally and exactly Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who has the dreams and is losing his faith, spoiler alert,
yeah,
kills himself.
Yes, kills himself.
One could imagine that the reaction would have been different, that this hideous reaction that happened might never have happened. And I wonder if you ever spend time thinking about that alternate history.
Yeah, I mean, I would have much preferred it, really. I mean, I was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was doing just fine. And I would have been happy to continue down that road. But I think it was one of the early instances of, I mean, something I try and write about in the memoir, of the creation of the kind of outrage industry, you know, where people like, you know, religious leaders try to find things that they can use to arouse the anger of the faithful.
Distortion and context be damned.
Yeah, and I just think that it's now actually something that is very, very consciously being done.
I and many people thought of you when this latest outrage and violence occurred, partly, as I was thinking about it, the guy who apparently made this bad video and the video are in some ways the real-life versions of what you were wrongly caricatured as 20 years ago.
I find it really very difficult to be bracketed with this individual because I have nothing but contempt for him, really, and I sort of flatter myself that I was doing something a little more serious than that.
You were definitely doing something more serious than that and better.
But he does seem – I mean, in this case, he clearly was malicious – and trying to do this to get a result, and boy, did he get it.
when you were last here and we were talking, you were working on this memoir, and you told me you'd waited in order to get some distance mm-hmm. on it, a distance from the Fatwa decade. It's now been a decade more since the British government declared your threat level insufficient to provide you with protection. What was the distance that you required, just a matter of time?
I always knew that it would come, you know. I mean, I always knew that I would write this book, which is why I kept a journal throughout that period, you know, so that I didn't forget important details. And I just thought I was going to leave it to instinct. There would be a moment when a little voice whispered in my ear and said, maybe you're ready to do this now. What I mean by this, really, and the thing that was what I most wanted to do was to tell not the so much the public story, because, you know, we've all read the newspapers, but to tell the private story, because I think certainly what's interesting to me, not just as a person, but also as a writer, is the way in which this small group of people, you know, a writer, his friends, his family, his publishers,
his policemen,
his yes, and his ex's new family of men with big guns, how they faced up to this extraordinary international attack, you know, and I think I hope that that's what would be interesting to people to read about. You know, imagine what would it be like if this happened to your family.
You write in the memoir about your imagining at a certain moment that you would transmute this into fiction and decided against it because?
Because I thought the thing that's interesting about it is that it's true. If this were just a made-up story, it would be a kind of tall story, really. And
if it were fiction, people would just say, oh, it's just this thin Romano clay about his life.
Exactly. But what I did feel I wanted to do when writing it, and I think I tried very hard to do, was to write it like a novel. I mean, that's to say, to use the techniques of the novel, of, you know, of form and language and characterization, to try and make it vivid, you know, to try and make the characters come off the page and live rather than be flat.
And is that one of the reason, for instance, that you are he rather than I throughout this book?
There's two reasons, really. One is that. One is that I thought it would make it feel more like more like a novel. I mean, like a novel in which everything's true, but nevertheless a novel. And the other is the question of how I should approach myself in this book. I knew very well, as kind of going in position, that I had to be probably tougher on myself than anyone else, because otherwise it reads like making excuses.
When you became their responsibility, the British security forces decided that you required an alias. I'd love you to read the section of the book about the choice you made.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is that they said I needed an alias, but I also needed to have not an Indian one. So it's a complicated and, you know, worrying thing to be asked to give up not only your name, but the ethnicity of your name, you know. And so I thought, well, if I can't have the ethnicity of my name, I can have the ethnicity of literature, which is like by other country. And it's written in the third person, as you were saying. He thought of writers he loved and tried combinations of their names. Vladimir Joyce, Marcel Beckett, Franz Stern. He made lists of such combinations, and all of them sounded ridiculous. Then he found one that did not. He wrote down side by side the first names of Conrad and Chekhov, and there it was, his name for the next 11 years, Joseph Anton. "Jolly good," said Stan, that's one of the cops. "You won't mind if we call you Joe." In fact, he did mind. He soon discovered that he detested the abbreviation for reasons he did not fully understand. After all, why was Joe so much worse than Joseph? He was neither one, and both should strike him as equally phony or equally suitable. But Joe grated on him almost from the beginning. Nevertheless, that monosyllable was what the protection officers found easiest to master and remember and avoid getting wrong in public places. So as far as they were concerned, Joe it had to be. Joseph Anton. He was trying to get used to what he had invented. He had spent his life naming fictional characters. Now, by naming himself, he had turned himself into a sort of fictional character as well.
That's Salman Rushdie reading from his new memoir, Joseph Anton, about the choice of ultimately that title. It's remarkable how much that if this memoir has objects of rage, it's not Iran or its mullahs or Islam. About the fanatics, you're more sort of Vonnegutian, so it goes. Your anger seems directed at British people, the government leaders who did not have your back, the newspapers kept saying you were a drain on taxes. The Archbishop of Canterbury, fellow writers like John le Carré, those are the people who still stick in your craw, yeah?
Well, you know, the people close to you are the people you get most annoyed with. You know, I mean, frankly, if bigots behave like bigots, then, as you say, so it goes, you know. But if people who ought to know better behave in a hostile way, then it's more shocking. I mean, I think one of the things that I found very difficult to deal with, and in a way still do find difficult to understand, is that there was an attempt almost from the beginning of this, not just to shift the blame and to say, you know, it's your fault, but to present me to the public as an extraordinarily unpleasant person.
In London during the early years of the Fatwa, you had a conversation with the great American publisher, Bob Gottlieb, who may have been the editor of The New Yorker at the time as well, and he made you very, very angry. Talk about that.
Well, the thing is about Bob, I mean, I have, you know, great affection for him in many ways because he was my publisher at Knopf for Midnight's Children and Shame. And I think when he said this thing that got up my nose, I think he was trying to be supportive. You know, he wasn't trying to be hostile.
And he said, if you'd known your book was going to kill people, of course you wouldn't have written it.
Yeah. And it's just that exact phrasing, you know, your book was going to kill people. I mean, I felt almost like somebody from the NRA saying, you know, books don't kill people, people kill people.
And right you'd be. I can imagine your restrained fury at the time when your life was in danger. Mm. 20 years later, do you think about that and reread that and rethink that and say, well, if I'd known what was going to happen, indeed, I wouldn't have published Satanic Verses?
No, I'm sorry. I just happened to not think that. You know, I mean, I think I wrote a completely legitimate book that was unfairly attacked. And as I say, in this age we live in, when violence can be whipped up, you know, almost overnight by people who use pretexts to do so, it was whipped up. And I mean, I can't help but believe that the people who whipped up the violence are the ones responsible for it.
You write interestingly again and again about how living under the special branch protection is nothing like one expects from the movies. There are no pre-existing safe houses. You had to find and rent your own hideouts. Is that what surprised you most?
Well, it was certainly very stressful, because, you know, when I was told that A, I couldn't go back to my own home, and B, that I had to find the places to go without actually being physically able to go and look for them. You know, so I mean, it was a conundrum that I could.
And you were friends with Joseph Heller, so you knew from Catch 22.
Exactly. This was, it's some catch, that Catch 22. And it made life very difficult. If there are safe houses, which, I mean, you know, I've read the spy novels too, I was never offered one.
You had to be a Soviet defector, I guess.
Or something important, yeah.
There are entertaining moments as well. Describe the incident where you're at a fun fair at an amusement park with your little son, and a special branch bodyguard steps in to get him the stuffed animal he wants.
Yes, this is one of our favorite bodyguards, actually, who called Fat Jack, we were at this amusement arcade, and there was a particular sort of soft toy that my son, who was then 10, I guess, decided that he liked the look of, but it was on the top shelf, so you had to be a really crack shot to get it. And of course, the gun sights are all ridiculously bent, and so the special branch officer saw my predicament. And stepped up and said, "You'd like that, would you?" He said to Zafar, and Zafar said, "Yes, please." So he went and picked up the gun, and then went sort of boom, 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 boom. Every single little paddle fell down, but while the kind of carny guy sort of standing there with
had
his,
no idea he'd been hustled.
No, with his mouth
by
literally
special branch,
his mouth literally hanging open, and at the end of it, Fat Jack said, "Okay, we'll have that one, please."
Good scene for the movie.
Yes, but I mean, you know, there were this a thing I used to say to my friends sometimes was that if it weren't for the fact that this isn't funny at all, there are bits of it that would be very funny.
Did you, as I'm sure I would have, try to calculate the odds of survival, saying, oh, probably yes, probably no, maybe yes, maybe no?
Well, it went up and down. I mean, there were two nightmare scenarios. One is, of course, that the killers would get you know, close enough to achieve the end. And the other was that it would sort of never end, you know, that there would just be this situation going on and on and on forever, and I would really never again be able to lead a normal life. And both of those were bad. I mean, I remember once being in a kind of armored car cavalcade in Paris when I'd gone there for some political meeting. They actually closed the Place de la Concorde so that my car could cross. And I thought, you know, really? And I remember seeing a little cafe just on the edge of Concorde where there are all these French folk with their coffee looking up at this ridiculous sight of my motorcade going by. And I remember from inside the bulletproof car longing to be one of those people sitting at that pavement cafe and just wondering if that would ever happen to me again. Would I ever just be able to be a person sitting on a sidewalk, you know, sipping an espresso?
Meanwhile, we find you have such marital and extramarital drama in your life. These fights, these betrayals, these multiple marriages and affairs and breakups. Did you feel obliged to be as candid about that as you
could? Well, I just thought, you know, it's an autobiography, you know, and nobody's making you write it, but, you know, but if you're going to write it, tell the truth. And so I wanted to, in a way, show in that novelistic way to say that this isn't about somebody who is either demonic or ideal.
He's just like you.
He's just a person. You know, it's a human being with all the faults and perhaps qualities of human beings, you know, trying to struggle through this thing. And I thought the more human I could make all the characters, but including the me character, including me, you know, the more people would see the reality of the situation.
I keep asking you hypotheticals, but nevertheless, I'm going to ask you another. Absent the fatwa and absent this bizarre change in your life for a decade, do you think your domestic life, your romantic lives would have been different, less volatile?
Unfortunately, I don't think so.
Really? You can't blame it. You can't blame the Ayatollah for your problems.
For that, I can't blame the Ayatollah, I'm afraid.
Your great novel, Midnight's Children, has finally been made into a movie by the director, Deepa Mehta, with a screenplay by yourself. Mm-hmm. It tells the story of an Indian child, one of hundreds of children, born at the exact moment that India achieved its independence in 1947. It starts earlier, though, with the boy's grandparents and parents. I want to play a clip from the film where the boy Salim's mother has fallen in love with a wanted man who has run afoul of religious politics and who is hiding in their basement. And her older sister is not happy about that.
Okay, I'm sorry, everyone, but is this really happening? They're going to get married and live in the cellar and we have to keep the secret? For how long? 10 years? This is ridiculous.
Please, Emerald. There might still be killers out there. I need some time. Some time, nah?
Okay. Okay. Hide on, like a fat worm under the ground.
That's from the Salman Rushdie written movie adaptation of his novel Midnight's Children, which is out later this fall. The novel was published in 1981. As I watched that scene, I go, wait a minute. Yeah. Is that really in the book? And I needed to go back and check that. There was a prophetic, prescient quality to the guy in the cellar for 10 years getting married.
Who happens to be a writer.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, you know, believe me, writing the screenplay, I thought that too. And I do think there's something very strange about the journey from Midnight's Children to Joseph Anton, that was a book which took aspects of my life and my family's life
and history
and fictionalize them. But I mean, it certainly came out of my family experience and so on. And that was that book. And then here's this book, which also takes, you know, my life, but doesn't fictionalize it, you know. And it's odd. I mean, they feel to me a little bit like, you know, the bookends, you know, these two books which stand at opposite ends of my writing life and both based in autobiography.
And this one without magical realist elements.
Yeah, this one without fiction.
Sir Salman Rushdie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Salman Rushdie's memoir, Joseph Anton, is out this week. You can hear my entire 45-minute long conversation with Salman Rushdie at studio360.org. Coming up, it's Andy Warhol's world. We just live in it.
You see, what he used to do is like ask a lot of questions and get a common denominator. He would ask everybody. And if maybe 10 people would say, oh, you should paint a dollar sign, then he would do it.
Andy Warhol's Campbell soup cans turn 50. That's in just a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Andy Warhol has been dead for 25 years, but he still commands more attention than almost any living artist. The Andy Warhol Foundation just made headlines by announcing that they're cashing out. They're going to sell or donate the thousands of works by Warhol that they have in storage. $100 million worth, the foundation believes. And this is a big Andy Warhol year, the 50th anniversary of his Campbell soup cans, the works that made him globally famous. To mark the occasion, Target is selling cans of actual tomato soup that have labels printed with Warhol's designs. I knew Andy Warhol a little bit, and he undoubtedly would have loved that mingling of his art and commerce. Studio 360's David Krasnow looked at the story of the soup cans for our series on American icons.
There are 32 soup cans on the wall at MoMA because there were 32 varieties of Campbell's soup when Warhol painted them. 32 varieties, 32 paintings. Pretty straightforward. Except that nobody in the history of painting had ever thought to paint a can of soup before. Nobody. And why would they have? Why paint a can of soup?
The honest answer for me is that he really loved America.
Sing a song of soup since Campbell's ghost is full.
And he loved what America's made available.
Pack a vacuum bottle of good hot Campbell's soup in every lunchbox.
He painted refrigerators with a turkey, and he painted washing machines and all these things that meant a lot to a family like his.
It would be the equivalent now of doing a portrait of a balance bar or a Luna bar. You know, it's fake food.
To take a banal subject and to elevate it to a profound degree is no mean trick.
It's a still life of the 60s, American industrial still life, because inside is contained onion, rice, barley, pepper, leeks, turnip.
That's what Campbell's soups are. Good.
The word can is slang for ass. So there is a sense that the can was, for Andy, rough trade. You know, like a sailor.
Maybe we better slow down here. This is Wayne Kustenbaum, a poet who wrote a biography of Warhol.
The drawings that he was most known for in the 50s were these I. Miller women's shoes, and there is nothing more swish than drawings of women's shoes. The can itself is hard, matte, unexpressive, kind of masculine.
In the late 50s, a young furniture salesman named Irving Blum decided to go into the art business. He became a partner at a new gallery called Ferris in Los Angeles. So he would take trips to New York to look for new artists, and he kept hearing about a guy named Andy Warhol.
He was doing these big, unfinished cartoon paintings.
Blum went back in 1962 to offer Andy his first solo show.
I walked into his little house again, and there were these Campbell soup paintings on the floor, and I said, what happened to the cartoons you were doing? He said, you know, I went to visit Leo Castelli, and there's somebody else, I can't remember his name, doing these cartoon pictures, doing them better than I was doing them.
Roy Lichtenstein had scooped Andy. So just like that, Andy gave up painting comics and started painting what he had for lunch every day.
Well, that's what the legend says, but there's a lot of legend about Warhol.
Ultraviolet was one of Andy's main collaborators in the 60s, and she may have given him the idea to paint soup cans.
There was a coffee shop in my building, and I remember sitting next to him, and he said one day, "What shall I do? What shall I paint?" And I said, "Well, you know, what's in front of you, whatever you eat, Campbell can soup."
But a lot of Andy's friends tell a similar story.
You see, what he used to do is, like, ask a lot of questions and get a common denominator. He would ask everybody. And if maybe 10 people would say, "Oh, you should paint a dollar sign," then he would do it.
Andy gave his oldest brother's family one of his early soup cans, a can of Pepper Pot. Here's his nephew, James Warhola.
As kids, we would take it to school and show it to the teachers and the other students. We put it in a paper bag. And it was since it was not a large painting, we could kind of probably carry my lunchbox in one hand and the painting in the other.
But Irving Blum knew all along the paintings were something special.
Coming into the gallery day after day, you know, they just set me thinking about what people, say, for example, in 100 years would think about those paintings.
Blum bought the whole group from Andy, paying him $100 a month for 10 months. And people thought he'd been taken for a fool. Like the guy who owned the gallery just a few doors down the block.
He put a stack of Campbell soup cans that he had bought at the local supermarket in his window and a big sign, "Buy them more cheaply here, 2 for 32 cents.
But Warhol knew that all publicity is good publicity.
He was mentioned in Time magazine, and I think in the family, we were all kind of excited because we had an uncle that was mentioned in Time magazine. That he was kind of on the cutting edge of a new art form or something.
Or something.
Nobody called it pop. There was no name. As a matter of fact, Ivan Karp dubbed the style communism. And happily, that name didn't stick.
If most people took the new pop art as a kind of joke, which maybe it was, the painting establishment was not laughing. Arthur Danto is a philosopher and art critic.
I'm not sure I've got the anecdote totally right, but he was at a party in East Hampton, and de Kooning was there, and de Kooning was drunk, and he said, "I hate you." He said, "You've destroyed art." He said, "You've destroyed beauty. You've destroyed laughter." And that was the end of it.
Abstract artists like de Kooning and Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Lee Krasner, they believed in painting. They reached deep into their souls and wrenched out these dramatic explosions onto the canvas that represented, well, something. You could never say for sure, but sure as hell not, a can of soup.
It seems a moment of a great sigh of relief that a certain ponderousness and pompousness of 1950s American art is finally over.
Wayne Kustenbaum, the Warhol biographer.
And that a know-nothing, swishy, pale, really profoundly inarticulate guy like Andy Warhol can change art history. One could say it's like Reagan becoming president, but I don't feel that way about it at all. Nonetheless, one could say that Andy Warhol's arrival as a kind of faux artist and being confused with a real artist was like this weird phenomenon of a fool like Reagan or Arnold Schwarzenegger being taken for a politician, that there's something kind of funny on the conceptual level about it, but deeply scary.
He was a mediocre painter. He would not have been thought of as anything very special.
Barbara Rose is an art historian who was a friend of Warhol's early in his career.
It was his ability to not be judged on his native ability as a draftsman or as a painter, his ability to persuade people through these brilliant tactical maneuvers. I mean, he opened up everything so anybody could walk in. And Andy was very instrumental in destroying all standards. There are no more standards in art, none. I'm an artist because I say I'm an artist. You market, you get a PR agent, it's in the magazines, that's it. And he certainly is the pivotal figure in that.
Warhol had figured out that in a culture inundated with images, in magazines, newspapers, on TV, an artist could make a career off manipulating images without inventing anything. It didn't matter how skillfully he painted the can of soup. That's why he quickly moved from hand-painting each one to silkscreening, producing near copies in quantity. Warhol created thousands of Campbell's soup images. Even the people at the Warhol Foundation aren't sure how many there are. But that didn't devalue them. Repetition, not originality, was the source of their power.
And at that time in the 60s, you had all those gurus coming from India, you know, East, Mid, West. And actually, if you go back to Buddhist, Buddha art, usually you just don't have a Buddha, or you have, you know, 20 Buddhas, and in the middle there's a big one. There's a Buddha painting with, I think, 365. So when Warhol did, for instance, 300 Coca-Cola bottle, it's sort of coming from there.
In other words, the soup cans and Coke bottles and dollar bills were like icons. Warhol recognized consumerism as the true American religion, and he would be its Michelangelo. He was the Michelangelo we deserved.
He said, well, the best museum really is Bloomingdale's. Well, what do you think the Museum of Modern Art is today? People don't go to museums to look at art. They go to museums to shop and go to the restaurants. It's all Bloomingdale's. Yeah, Andy really saw the future.
Barbara Rose thinks Warhol was a cynic who just painted things that stupid people would take for art. But most people who knew Warhol agree that he genuinely loved fame. And the Campbell soup can was as famous as the movie stills of Marilyn and Elvis he was painting, and about as substantial.
I think he first of all imagined that there was nothing inside the can. I think that he could face that nothingness the way he faced death when he was nearly killed, and the way he faced his own enigmas and his own loneliness. So I think he was really content to know that there was nothing in that can. No meaning, no significance, just a simulacrum of love or being taken care of.
In the mid-1980s, Warhol did a series of Campbell's soup boxes, mixes for instant chicken noodle soup, that kind of thing. It was only a year or two before he died, and by that time, Campbell's just looked like a pure nostalgia item. I don't believe that Andy was just a social commentator, or just a cynic, or just gay. I think he really loved soup. For Studio 360, I'm David Krasnow.
I don't know. I used to have lunch with him a lot. I don't ever remember him eating Campbell's soup. He was, you know, very informed about nutrition. He wouldn't eat that crap.
There's more on Warhol soup cans at studio360.org, along with all the other works we've explored in our American Icons series. The TV show Dallas, Monticello, Moby Dick, Charlie Chaplin's Tramp, The Barbie Doll, Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, and lots more. That's all at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up now in Studio 360, a pop culture juggernaut caught at the moment it started.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
The history of MTV is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Minus 10, 9, 8.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. One summer night back in 1981, a scruffy group of New York rock and roll fans and freshly minted TV executives took a bus across the Hudson River to New Jersey to celebrate the launch of their new cable channel.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
Why Jersey? Well, 30 years ago, no one carried MTV in New York City. And that may have been a blessing in disguise, because the first broadcast was a mess.
It was a total unmitigated disaster. We also had done stereo TV for the first time. But most of the studios had been set up for mono. So listening in stereo sounds fine. You listen in mono, which 99.9% of the people did, and suddenly either it wasn't there, it kind of looked good. And everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. Probably one of the worst nights of my life. Everybody else is having a party and celebrating.
Right.
I'm having a heart attack.
That is one of MTV's founders, Bob Pittman. He's one of 400 people interviewed for I Want My MTV. It's an oral history assembled by Rob Tannenbaum and Craig Marks, now out in paperback. MTV would go on to shape pop culture in lots of ways, transforming not just the music industry, but TV and movies. When the channel was founded, according to Craig Marks,
people didn't even know what music videos were. So you're going to kind of launch a whole, you know, back then maybe like, what, a $30 million network based on this thing that no one's really ever seen. It's counterintuitive, to say the least.
And the big tactical achievement that they did early on was the I Want My MTV campaign.
That's
that
right.
Got those local people to say, I guess we got to put it on.
It's a brilliant, you know, one of the more brilliant advertising campaigns ever, in that it went around these gatekeepers and it roped in rock stars who, you know, usually get a lot of money for that kind of stuff. And this was all done for nothing.
People like Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger, Pete Townsend, the Police. I mean, what it did, it actually got people to go ahead and call their local cable operators, like Sting told you to call your local cable company and demand your MTV. And that's what people actually did.
America, demand your MTV. I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
MTV, music, television, video, music, 24 hours a day, and it's stereo.
So, do you remember the first time you ever watched MTV?
I do. I was selling pots and pans door to door as a summer job in college, and I was in the Philadelphia area, and I went to a house and was let in the door, and they were watching television, and I saw this music video, and I was like, what the heck is this? And it was MTV, and I'd never heard of it and didn't have cable where I lived, but that's how I found it.
It sort of, among other things, brought the music business back to life, didn't it?
Sure. Yeah. The music business had been suffering very badly. It was the post-disco doldrums, and disco really, was a bubble economy for the music biz. And so that was the late 70s, early 80s, and it was in real dire straits. And also, in some ways, classic rock radio, which was the dominant rock radio form, was very conservative and very staid, and was very hard to get new music played. And the lifeblood of the record industry is getting new bands played. So MTV would basically play any video from anyone who was signed to a record company, as long as you were white, it turned out. And so they did. And so that's how all these new British bands, such as the Stray Cats, who sort of got their start in London, and Duran Duran. And
so everything we know as 80s music.
Right. Just was kind of a byproduct of this weird economy in the music video industry, where these bands loved the kind of theatrical nature of videos, and they were really early to adapt them. And then MTV had really no choice but to play them because they had nothing else.
Yeah. Well, and then once it started working, the central genius business idea, which is to say, oh, the record industry will pay for our content and we'll make all the money.
Right. It's the greatest thing, that it's the internet all over again. We'll just take your content for free. MTV was like a national radio station that played a Michael Jackson song next to a Duran Duran song next to a Guns N' Roses song. And that was really hard to find. That didn't exist in radio. And I think that's pretty profound that they were able to do that.
That's interesting. So we had the free-form FM DJs of the late 60s and 70s who did a version of that. But this, you're saying, did it again, putting really unlike kinds of music side by side.
Right, exactly. And an interesting thing in the book is there's a chapter about when MTV decided to finally play a black artist in for real, which was Michael Jackson in the Billie Jean video. And they didn't really want to play it, and they deny that still to this day, but essentially they had their hand forced. CBS was going to pull all their videos. So they played the video, and it became a pretty good-sized hit, and then Beat It followed that and became a bigger hit, and then Thriller became essentially the most important video of all time, music video. And immediately MTV started playing this video all the time. So they went from, in 1 week, we're not going to play black artist to, we're going to play Michael Jackson and Prince every minute of the day.
But surely they didn't say, we can't play black musicians.
No, but they did. You know, the people who founded MTV, especially from the programming end of it, were all radio people. And they thought that based on their radio experience, the only music to play for that audience was rock music. And then later on, almost the same way they played Thriller and Michael Jackson, they kind of accidentally stumbled upon playing hip-hop by starting this show called Yo MTV Raps.
In 1988.
Right, which was only supposed to be on at Saturday at 2 in the morning and all of a sudden brought in all these crazy rating numbers. And then in the MTV fashion, the next thing you know, it's on every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yo.
One of my producers who grew up in the Great Plains during that era said that was his godsend. That made him feel connected to culture beyond Wichita.
Yeah, absolutely. When we spoke to Jazzy Jeff, he said when MTV would play their videos, he would go home to Philadelphia for like a summer barbecue and everyone would have the same haircut that he did in the video. And there was no other way that they would know about that. That was the way that you found out if you were in L.A., what New York hip-hop was about and what it looked like and what they were wearing, which was very important.
Really? So it really was the sort of the one national venue for that subculture?
Absolutely. It was the social network of that culture. And so you can, you know, that was the only way you can find out that there was even a scene in Houston.
I sit alone in my four-cornered room staring at candles.
When I interviewed Scarface from the Ghetto Boys, they were just excited because it put Houston on the map. It was a national platform for hip-hop then.
At night I can't sleep, I toss and turn, candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. Four walls just staring at a nigga, I'm paranoid sleeping with my finger on the trigger. My mother's always stressing I ain't living right, but I ain't going out without a fight. See, every time my eyes close, I start sweating and blood starts coming out my nose.
When MTV finally, despite its ongoing disinclination to play rap, people there still didn't get it. You have this MTV executive named Patty Galluzzi,
mm-hmm.
who says that even her colleagues didn't quite get it. Let's listen to her.
She didn't understand what a word meant. Like in rap videos, they would call somebody a herb.
Right.
And she would go, oh, that's obviously a reference to drugs, to marijuana. And we'd go, no, Michelle, he's a nerd. If you're a herb, you're a nerd. If it was a drug reference, Michelle, it would be herb. And then there was something, I remember once she said, there's all these derogatory terms against homosexuals in this video.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, really? What are you talking about? She said, well, he's constantly calling this guy a homie.
In that clip, I should say that Michelle, is the woman being referred to, is the head of standards and the one woman
the
standards and practices department. So in the earlier days of MTV playing hip hop, I think the artists were pretty much left alone. The budgets for rap videos were one-tenth what they were for rock videos.
What are some of the bands that maybe wouldn't have made it at all absent MTV?
I mean, in some ways, an entire genre of music, new wave. The Cars, Duran Duran, Thompson Twins, ABC, Human League, all these 1980s haircut bands, as they're called, would never have found an audience here because radio was never going to play them. I mean, even a U2 probably would have had a much harder time finding an audience without the support of MTV. And MTV was crazy about U2. They played them from the very beginning. And then hair metal also probably would have had – so Twisted Sister – Dee Snider in the book says, you know, we needed MTV, but MTV really needed us, talking about all the hair metal bands because they were visual. They
right.
were theatrical.
And it was all about theater, exactly, and scantily clad girls and the rest.
Yeah, and explosions. And, you know, if you think of like 70s American rock, like the Eagles, for example, the Eagles never had an MTV presence, really. And they just were kind of drab looking. You know, they wore what they wore. They wore blue jeans and shirts, and they sang songs, and they just wanted to stand there. And they were great musicians, and that's what they really cared about. I mean, they cared about girls, too, but they weren't about putting on a show. And MTV wanted – it was a visual medium. MTV wanted bands who put on shows. But those bands, you know, just became wildly successful. You know, the fourth tier hair metal bands became million sellers. The Bullet Boys, you know, bands who sounded like Motley Crue. On the other hand, there's a great, a great chapter in the book devoted to one video by Billy Squire, who was this hard rock artist. The video is called Rock Me Tonight. And it did actually ruin his career. This video killed Billy Squire's career. It was directed by Kenny Ortega, who
became a director.
Right. And it was a little bit fey. Rocking the night, I'm walking on air. Go find me some trouble, go grab my share. But this video had him kind of prancing in a New York City loft in silk pajamas, kind of skipping, I mean, I think literally skipping from one end of the loft to the other. But Billy Squire says, and his managers say, that this killed his career. He went from playing 12,000-seat arenas to, a month later, barely selling 4,000 tickets. Radio stopped playing him.
And when I read that, what I thought of is his base, these young white teenagers. Basically, I thought of Beavis and Butthead oh, man, Billy Squire sucks. And then, of course, MTV, now that we're talking about Beavis and Butthead, that's where they existed in the 90s, right at the end of what you call what was MTV's golden age in the mid-90s. And here you have a show of horrible caricatures of their audience slagging music videos as a program.
And doing so brilliantly.
And doing it absolutely brilliantly.
Is this Spinal Tap?
Tap is cool.
This isn't Spinal Tap. This sucks.
Yeah, this sucks.
Where'd these guys get their clothes?
They bought it at a rock and roll store at the mall.
Yeah.
Was that the last hurrah of the golden age?
Well, in some ways, it's the last hurrah. It might be the last hurrah of music videos, because MTV still thought that we can do this kind of programming, but it has to center on music. And in their case, it has to center on music videos. So that was MTV's probably last time where they thought music videos were at the center of our programming. There are plenty of artists who hated Beavis and Butthead, whose videos got significant career-boosting airplay in 1986 or 7 or 8 or 9. And then 3 years later or 4 years later, they were being reamed by Beavis and Butthead. And there's a story of Kip Winger, who is this hair metal singer, calling up a program executive at MTV saying, how could you do, at midnight, saying, how could you do this to me? They're making fun of my video. Make it, take it off now.
Shut up.
You suck.
Stop. In the name of all that which does not suck.
What, was there anything surprising that you learned in all these hundreds of interviews?
You know, in a sweet sense, what I was surprised at was how fondly almost everybody who we spoke to looks back at this era, and they all mourn this kind of last gasp of the music monoculture. And I think they miss also the kind of wild, wild west part of, which is a kind of cliche quote that runs throughout the book, you know, the music videos, of making these music videos. No artist likes to make music videos. It's, you know, it's just
ridiculous.
It's also against their constitution. They have to stand around for hours and hours and hours and just wait. And they realize this is a really good art form. And the directors that we talked to also really missed the idea of coming up with an idea for a video, and then in 2 weeks being able to see your little movie on television all the time. That kind of immediacy. As directors, David Fincher, Michael Bay, they got their start making music videos.
Well, and speaking of that, I remember practically the moment, I guess in the 90s, when people started saying about movies in theaters, oh, it's the MTV effect, oh, this quick cutting. And certainly in action movies, that's true. Do you think it's true in general? Did MTV and these three-minute forms of quick cutting transform cinema?
I think it probably more massively impacted the quote-unquote art form of television commercials, which really did become complete cops of the way that music videos look and feel. But I do think, yeah, I mean, I think Michael Bay's movies are big, expensive music videos where nothing has to really make sense as long as there's just something cool to look at.
And some music.
And some really loud music.
Cut to music.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it worked as this both cool, hip thing and this massive thing is because it started before there was an internet. In the digital age where everything is so fractured and everybody can go deep into their own little niche, can another equivalent cultural thing happen like MTV?
You're asking me. Probably not in the same way. But, you know, on the other hand, music videos are still the main reason why people go to YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, video budgets have been cut. I interviewed plenty of people in the book who are producers who worked at record labels, let's say, who were in charge of making videos. And they say the budgets now are what they were in 1982. So they've come completely full circle because there is no MTV. There's no national platform where
telling you these are the 10 you should be caring about right now.
And you know everyone's going to watch them at the same time. When Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle premiered on MTV, or when Smells Like Teen Spirit very famously got its legs on MTV, everything changed. You know, and that's exaggerated, and it's not as true as it seems now. But still, there's enough truth in there to make it worth saying. It's hard to imagine there's that one place now that can produce that kind of change.
Craig Marks, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Craig Marks is the co-author of I Want My MTV, which is now out in paperback. And here's what we want to know from you. What was your favorite music video from MTV's golden age? Mine is probably Smells Like Teen Spirit, although my guilty pleasure favorite was Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love. Tell us yours at studio360.org. Now whip it into shape. Shape it up. Get straight. Go forward. Move ahead. Try to detach it. It's not too late. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Julia Wetherill,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Leibowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From hot, hot, hot young movie star to middle-aged searcher for truth, beauty, and awesome vistas.
You know, maybe it doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't mean it isn't right, right? Doesn't mean you can't try.
Andrew McCarthy on his new book, The Longest Way Home. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.